So this week we're talking about classical art. Just make sure my pens work. Escaping everywhere. So the classical period encapsulates both the Greek and the Roman cultures. If we think in terms of the Spenglerian kind of attitude that we spoke about last week, we might see, if you remember that, that was that everyone lives within a society, but some societies become cultures, which is essentially a group of people who have, everything kind of syncs together. So their cultural attitudes, their language, their poetry, their visual arts, their theories of governance, their military structures, their religions, and all of it comes together with the geography of the place they're in and perfectly kind of situates them in a meaningful world and a meaningful universe. And when you have that magical moment of a culture coming about, a strong culture, that can then develop to become a civilization. And at the root of these big civilizations, which are, you know, large groups of people, usually spanning a huge kind of empire geographically, the core of Spengler's mission, message is that the civilization, the thing that its downfall is contained in the culture that it comes from, and after it kind of falls to bits, it returns to a series of small-scale societies. So as with the Egyptians, where we saw the Nile give birth to this culture that was sort of perfectly situated, this culture of order and immortality and a kind of immortal sense of proportion that then lasted for 4,000 years. Here in the classical period, it's more dynamic, it's more alive, but it grows out of Greece, and we have this Greek culture which kind of reaches its high point in Periclean Athens. And this gets picked up by the Romans when they invade and becomes the kind of way of seeing in the world for the Roman Empire. But the Roman Empire grows huge, like a civilization tends to, based on its early success, its military mindset. But then it stratifies, it ossifies, it becomes kind of rigid and hollow, and ultimately it then falls to bits again, leading to a kind of generalized social breakdown and lots of little small-scale societies, which is where we're going to end today. But during this time, classical art comes around, and classical art is the root and the foundation of the Western art tradition and the kind of aesthetic philosophies of that tradition. Cut forward to show you a bit of classical art here. So it includes things, well, underlying all of it is this idea of humanity, I guess of the heroic individual is at the core of that idea. So whereas last week we talked about the kind of all-abiding power of order and hierarchy in the Egyptian worldview, such that even the individual human doesn't matter, even the pharaoh is purely important because of the figure that he embodies. The classical world does have, again, this idea of there being a kind of universal order, and we can see that in their very geometrical and sort of squared-off architecture. But underlying this is an appreciation of the individual, of the fact that the heroic individual and, you know, small groups of people carry the meaning of the whole world on their backs. And it's sort of an idealization of the individual. And part of this is the idealization of the human form, the individual as they exist in matter. And so we see a lot of nudes. We see a careful attention being paid to both anatomy and kind of increasingly kind of sophisticated views of anatomy being placed in sculpture and stone, but also of attitude and of the individual physiognomy of people. Like, capturing the emperor's face becomes really important, as opposed to just showing him as a kind of ideal form or a rough sketch of a person. We shall go through the classical period looking out for this development of an appreciation for the individual human, but also this kind of concurrent appreciation of the human form. And it's kind of buried in there are the seeds of the downfall of this civilization as well. So we begin here at our kind of luxurious view of the Greek landscape. Greece itself is kind of ideally suited geographically for the development of a kind of heroic worldview. In terms of its landscape, it's got a lot of these shrubs, it's got a lot of rocks, it's very hot, it's very fertile. It was even more fertile back then than it is now, so food is plentiful, and you know, the days are long, there's plenty of time to fill. And it also, because it's kind of rocky and craggy, small-scale societies can do well there. Whereas in the desert, it tends to be that people have to group together because giant armies can march around, huge empires can be formed. The emphasis when you're in a kind of difficult to navigate territory is on small heroic bands of heroes and bandits, an individual city. So the Greek city-states had no central leader. They were simply a kind of confederation of states. Each one had its own separate government. And outside of those cities, there was no government at all. It was kind of just allegiances, tribes, things like this. The scrubland itself is a kind of, makes a perfect environment for the polytheism that they had, the kind of vision of there being gods up at the top, and there were kind of lesser gods, spirits like the Nereids and the Dryads and the nymphs who lived in the rivers and in the scrubs and kind of were inhabiting and causing chaos and danger around. Life itself was very adventurous. If you've ever been walking in the Greek countryside, you can kind of appreciate how these myths work. You tend to stumble into something that you shouldn't stumble upon, and you've either got to fight or run. And that the gods themselves kind of live in this chaotic state of constantly fighting, running, causing mischief. If you want a really good myth for the kind of way in which the Greeks related, or the classical world in general, related to its gods, because they weren't kind of good gods. There was no sense of justice with the gods. There's none of the things that we expect in a post-Christian world that a god would do. Instead, their gods are just like big, powerful humans that are kind of terrifying. There's a story of Achaon the Hunter who ran into Artemis slash Diana, depending on how you define her. Artemis slash Diana is the virgin goddess of the hunt. She travels around with the animals and is sort of an all-powerful kind of figure who's always causing chaos. She can never be won over by human man or by male gods. She's the spirit of the forest. And Achaon the Hunter was a great hunter. He went out one day with all of his dogs, hoping to run into some deer and to bring back a big stag, maybe, to bring home to his family. And he goes out and he sees a little bit of movement in some of these scrubs. And he knows from his experience that that's near a clearing where there's a bit of clear water. And that's a really good place to catch a deer and to trap them and to set the dogs on them. And so he goes through and he peeks through one of these bushes, and it's Artemis, and she's naked and she is bathing in the spring. He panics, he turns and he runs, he thinks, I've seen one of the gods naked, and it's, you know, if you're going to see one of them naked, that's the worst one to see naked, because she is really, you know, a vicious person. And he runs and he's like apologizing, but she has seen him, she's heard him, so she turns him into a stag, and he's torn apart by his dogs. I like that one because it gives you a sense of how, when you're looking at a picture of the geography of Greece like this, you can get a sense of how danger was behind every turn, so you had to be adventurous. But also gives you a sense of the cruelty of their gods and the kind of sense of there being no justice or order to the world. Because he chanced upon it by mistake, and he has immediately started apologizing as soon as he turned around, but that's not how the classical gods work. So he was torn apart by his own dogs. This is a seafaring set of nations. Well, it sort of is. Some of it's, I've got a little map here on the top right. The area in red, that is the city-state areas. The places like Athens, like Lesbos, like Crete, like Rhodes. These were all individual city-states with a lot of merchants, a lot of travel around on boats in kind of very rough landscapes like this, with the beautiful blue sea and the powerful looking cliffs. And then you've got areas like the tribal areas here that are in blue, and so that includes places like Sparta, Aeola, Thessaly, Macedonia, where Alexander the Great comes from. And you tend to find that each of them have their own preferred myths, the ones on land preferring, they have their own heroes, like Hercules is preferred in the tribal areas, whereas Odysseus is preferred in the boat areas. But in both of these cases, the emphasis is upon sort of strong individual warriors going out into the world, having adventures. It's an adventurous landscape. It kind of encourages it. And there's a lot of that kind of camaraderie, in that spirit of camaraderie, undergirding the way that they see the world. So in politics, the great image that underlies all of the kind of political discussions of Athens is the idea of a ship of state. And we still have this today. It's the idea we're all in the same ship together. We can't rock the boat or we'll fall out. We all have to move in the same direction. And it's an image that would be familiar to sailors who have to live very close to each other in close, you know, contact. And even if they don't get on, they all have to work together because they're all in the same boat. This is very different to the images that you get of Egypt. The images that you get presented of the world through the Egyptians' eyes are of an all, you know, it's a path through the universe. It's an all-consuming vision of the world. Their idea of order is eternal, whereas everything's quite small scale with the Greeks. Even though it's seen as equally as important, it's about a couple of guys on a boat, you know. The Odyssey, the Iliad, is handfuls of people. The Iliad has bigger battles, but the Odyssey is this huge long book, and it's just about a few guys on a boat, ultimately. So if you look at the development of their art styles, here are some Etruscan and Cretan poetry, pottery that comes from just before the archaic Greek styles. Etruscans are all the way out on what's now Italy, but were essentially Greek peoples. And the Cretans, again, they're not the mainland Greece, but they're Greek peoples. These are two vases showing us images of Heracles/Hercules, however you want to pronounce it. Hercules is an early hero of the Greek peoples. He goes out and he does his labors. He becomes one of the gods by performing godlike feats, which is itself a very kind of humanistic view that a human being could become a god as long as they're strong and tough and immortal enough in the way that they face down the world. And he's always facing down the world in the form of monsters and snakes. And kind of snakes, you know, they're deceptive, they're slithery, they're out there. The Hydra is constantly giving birth to new snake heads, they're always jumping out. This is the Medusa, who turns them into stone, has snakes for hair, a big monster's face in this rendering, and a series of kind of terrifying wings, making it very powerful. And all of this is the image of the heroic individual hero going out and sort of facing down nature. It's a very different image of the world and of order, I suppose, than we get in Egypt. In Egypt, order is all-consuming, the world is ordered. Whereas here, the world itself is presented as, you know, nature in its chaos, chaotic, raw form. There's, if you go out into the world, there's dangerous things. But order is something that heroic individuals go out and kind of bring to the world. Your job is to be sort of active in the world, bringing order out of the kind of dangers that are surrounding you. And so here we have some archaic period sculptures. This is from around 500 BC. And these sculptures show us some of the origins of this classical style. We can see, for example, in this, it was a kind of stretcher bearer figure. There's a nude guy, which you don't see in Egypt, and is something that... There's arguments as to whether earlier on in Greek sculpture that they sculpted the naked person and then they added clothes on and they kind of dressed them, because we know that they painted them and that they sometimes put ornaments on them, and so maybe they sculpted them naked and then put things around them. But then here's another sculpture of a woman who is sculpted with clothes and with hair. You can see that there's a lot of that geometrical stuff that's being taken over. There's a lot of trade at this point with Egypt and with the general sort of Middle East and the large, old, much older empires that exist there. So this dog, which, well, I know it's probably a lion, but it's kind of a dog-looking lion. It's got a lot in common with a lot of the sculptures that we see from Assyria and that move over to Persia. I mean, it's a long time away, but when we get to studying Eastern art, you'll notice the same sort of figures appearing in India that get carried over by this kind of cultural transmigration of imagery. But it's a very ordered set of figures compared to what we're used to in the later classical period. And that's because this sort of sculpture and sculptor techniques that are taken from Egypt are being used and are being adapted slowly but surely into things that are useful for the Greeks. It's only really when we hit a later period, so here we got two from 350 and 250 BC. These are the Doriphoros, which are some of the earliest kind of idealized male figures. These are, Doriphoros means the spearman, so you've got one from Polykleitos, and then this one's just a generalized Doriphoros. this comes from the early period, the first kind of period of the classical, the Hellenistic period, they sometimes call it, of sculpture. And here you've got the emergence of the classical from that origins that are borrowed from Egypt. They've learned what is to be learned from Egyptian sculptors and from sculptors from that tradition of like making everything very orderly. And now they've added a much more realistic approach to it. You can see the anatomy is almost kind of medical grade in the amount that you can see underneath the skin there. Adopting marble also helps because marble is soft, and marble has this quality to it that sort of shimmers and can almost look translucent. Like, as long as you carve it correctly, it can almost look like skin being pulled over bones and over muscles. And so you've got this real appreciation for the human form in its physical manifestation. But what you also have with this celebration of nude figures at this period is a kind of development of the idea of a nude as its own form. So there's Kenneth Clarke, who's a really great writer on art. He did a series called Civilization in about 1969-1970. I'd recommend having a watch of it. Maybe don't just sit down and watch it back to back, because it can get a bit dull because it's quite old, it's very slow moving. But a few episodes of Civilization are definitely worth watching. He set up a tension in the way that he speaks about. He wrote a book about the nude, and he talks about the nude and the naked as being two sort of opposites. So that nakedness is more what we would associate with ourselves. You know, if all our clothes fell off on a busy street, we would be naked. We would feel the shame of not having any clothes. We try and cover ourselves up. You know, it's like Adam and Eve after the fall. They suddenly realize they're naked, and it's like a panic. It's a kind of being extremely vulnerable. It's when you dream of being naked, it means that you're really vulnerable. But the nude is like the opposite of that. The nude is someone who is naked, but that nakedness almost fulfills them and gives them power. So to put clothes on a Greek nude is almost to make them less powerful. They become ideal figures by the kind of absolute lack of self-awareness about being naked. Like, these spearmen are just kind of, they're there, they are what they are. And, you know, the fact that they're naked kind of fulfills this image of the perfect man. It's the man is the measure of things. I also like to think about the inherent tension in the question of the nude. So with figures like this that are idealized, we are probably looking at a kind of, well, I like to think of it in terms of a comparison of aspiring and desiring. So here, these are very aspiring images. They're images that create, you know, this was at the time when the Spartans were the most powerful of the Greek cities, and their view of the world was about strong men who could, you know, rule the world and had the world at their feet because of their sort of internal strength. That the physical strength that they had was like a manifestation of their internal intellectual strength and their moral power. And so when they sculpted things like this, it was to create something to aspire to. And that kind of idealized body, you can see the way that the light falls across it, it has that, they call it, you know, statuesque for a reason. These statuesque bodies kind of are a living embodiment, not only of physical perfection, but of a kind of moral and intellectual perfection of the soul. But there's also, inherently in these sculptures, a kind of buried core of, as well as aspiring, a kind of desiring, that there's something about these bodies, presenting these bodies out there, that makes them into desirable objects. And as we see, and will see in a couple of slides time, the emergence of an Athenian kind of approach to sculpture, we'll see that rather than being images of an ideal that you aspire to, it's an images of an ideal that you desire to possess. Whether that's possessing them in the sense of owning the sculpture, or whether it is depicting a human body that you would like to possess sexually, which is clearly a big impact on the way that Greeks look at sculpture. They're not quite as prudish as we are in seeing human forms as being purely something to admire cerebrally. In the way that they write about statues and things like that, they do you know, talk about them as erotic objects. But anyway, got a bit sidetracked. This is the kind of Spartan style stuff. Sparta is a tremendously communal and almost, if you're going to put it in modern terms, you say communistic society. It was a city-state. They had two kings. The kings were elected by the warrior classes, to be a Spartan was to be a member of a warrior class. The reason they had two kings was that the kings had power over each other and were supposed to be in a constant state of war, constantly watching out because the other one at any time could try and kill them. This was because the ideal of a Spartan was someone who was relentless in their pursuit of their own kind of image of virtue and honor on the battlefield. So these are called kylixes. They are communal soup bowls. So they lived communally, they had no possessions except those that were owned by all the rest of the Spartans. They trained together and they ate together, and all that they ate was the black soup. We don't know what was in the black soup. We know it was kind of gross because the Athenians write about it and make jokes about how awful this black soup is. And we can probably presume it had a lot of protein in it because we see, you know, the sculptures of the people at the time, and they all tend to be very athletic looking. But they would drink from these bowls and pass them around. And these bowls are quite big, the kylixes. You can see here on the top left, the image includes some of the stuff they've taken from the Egyptians. So you've got the eagle, we've got the sun, image of Ra being imposed. But later on, it moves into more kind of depicting their own lifestyle, which is hunters, weaponry, the food that they eat. There's even been some suggestion that this is like a recipe for the black soup. It might include fish and poultry and a little bit of, that looks a bit like a horse rather than a cow. But you know, a little bit of everything in the black soup. Women also trained alongside the men in Spartan society. There was women, you know, were trained to use weaponry. They were trained for battle. In practice, they wouldn't go to battle, but it was seen as being part of raising strong children. If a woman died in childbirth, she was given the exact same funeral as a man who died on the battlefield. It was seen as, you know, as a warrior culture. Also a kind of terrifying culture. As soon as your baby was born, they got left out overnight. And only those that survived being left overnight and coming back in the morning and picking them up, only those still alive would be allowed to become Spartans. The rest would die. And the Spartans would celebrate because that was a weak Spartan that they've avoided raising. They also had this class called the Helots, who basically make Roman slaves, it makes the life of a Roman slave look quite cushy by comparison. The Helots basically had not only no rights and had to, you know, work every single day to make the food and the objects for the Spartans, but also they could just be killed for pleasure almost by the Spartans. To become a Spartan man, to move from a boy to a man, the young men were sent out at night and they had to murder a helot in cold blood and bring the body back. And only when they'd committed this murder could they become one of the Spartans. But once they were a Spartan, they were part of this warrior elite. And all of the other Greek cities looked up to this image of the Spartan as the kind of perfect, sort of very vicious, but kind of a man of total will and women of total will. Like, you don't mess with a Spartan. The Athenians, by comparison, have got a lot more of a cosmopolitan society, what we would see as a sophisticated society, one that's based on trade, upon theatre, philosophy. They had a democracy in that everyone who was a citizen of the Athenian state could go and vote and take part in the political debates. As we'll see later, there was responsibilities associated with this as well. But they also had their own kind of unusual relationship, shall we say, to the human body. So a lot of the sculptures that come out of Athens in the Athenian style celebrate the young man and the kind of the beauty of the young man. So with the Critias boy from 480 BC, you're looking at someone probably between the ages of 17 and early 20s, whereas you've got worrying ones like the Athebe from 330 BC, who looks a lot younger. The blonde boy from 480 BC is sort of typical of the kind of facial features that you find in these, what are essentially erotic objects or eroticized objects, at least desiring rather than aspiring. Objects of kind of the boys that were desired by the older men. So there was essentially an institutionalized paedophilia system which ran within the citizenship of the Athenians. They believed that a younger boy could trade his kind of his erotic desirability, his sexual favors, with an older man, and that man would give him, you know, military training, philosophical training, and would introduce him to the world of the Athenian elite. Yeah, it was a system that was essentially based on sexual exploitation, and this and the level of sculpture that develops out of it cannot be separated from the fact that these are essentially erotic objects, or at least eroticized objects. People became extremely good at sculpting the human form, in part because they were in a society that looked at young men as sexual objects. There is a myth, for example, of Pygmalion, which the famous version of it is from Ovid, who's a late stage Roman poet. But I have a feeling that the original version probably featured a boy, which was that there was a sculptor called Pygmalion who was so sickened by the kind of sexual looseness that he saw around him that he locked himself in his room and he worked on the sculpture of the perfect boy, or in Ovid's version, the perfect woman. And Aphrodite, seeing this act of worship, rewarded him by turning the sculpture into a living flesh, and they lived happily ever after. There are later retellings of this, especially in translations of Ovid, in which there's kind of the sculpture gets its own back because the sculpture gets turned to a human, then rejects Pygmalion and goes off with another attractive person. I think in the post-Christian mindset, you've got a sense of justice there, and it wraps up the story in a much nicer way. But it tells us something about the philosophy of the classical period, that that was the happy ending for them, that someone sculpted their perfect, you know, love object, and the object came to life, and they got to possess them, and that's like the happy ending of the story. The Athenian sort of depiction of women is intriguing because it tends towards making them more masculine looking. So whereas a lot of the desirable features in men were feminized, the desirable features in women, or at least the ones that were kind of sculpted, were masculinized, to an extent that it might be that the women were more aspired to, whereas the men were desired. So Matea Athena is the symbol of Athens. She is like the embodiment of Athens as Athena. She always is given these big square shoulders. She has what becomes a Roman nose with the kind of the thick forehead and the big nose that we find also with some of the kind of insolent looking young boys. It's this kind of contemptuous look, this kind of self-satisfied, self-contained look. There's a look of judgment. You see it here as well, the bust of Aspasia, who was a kind of noble woman. It depicted with a look of disdain, of haughtiness, of kind of, yeah, it's that idea of the person who contains everything within themselves. They contain their own hierarchy and will, and they're kind of a manifestation of power, and their facial features and their body, in the case of the armor, and, you know, there's a sort of severed head down here hanging from Athena. That's giving you a sense of their kind of moral power. But it's unusual in Athens, because Athens, we know from historical texts, was not a matriarchal society. They seem to really like statues of powerful, matriarchal-looking women. But in practice, Athenian women were largely kind of, they weren't really allowed out in public without chaperones. They wore veils a lot of the time. There's a real kind of Taliban vibe that you get from the high points of the Athenian culture, which isn't shown at all in their sculpture, which is quite fascinating. Now, to do a little bit of history, the turning point between the Sparta's time hegemonically, which means that as the most important city-state in the Greek Confederation, being replaced by Athens, happens with the Battle of Marathon. So the Battle of Marathon is after the 300, which you're probably familiar with from the movie. So in the 300 at Thermopylae, 300 Spartans fight off a gigantic army of Persians. So that ties us right back to our start, where we talked about the geography of Greece helping individual strong fighters. But ultimately, it was not the Spartan sort of individual warriors who beat the Persians. When the Persians came through, they were defeated by an army that was led by the Athenians. The Spartans didn't have time to get there, and the Athenians had beaten them on the ocean, and then they all came together and formed what were called hoplites. So some of you would probably be familiar with these from video games and things. The hoplites were not strong individually, but they were strong as a group. It was a series of men who were used to, you know, working out naked together in the gymnasia, who trained together with weapons, and they would move incredibly close to each other with huge shields, forming an impenetrable barrier of arms and armor. And they had huge, long, like 12 to 14 foot spears that they would push out from the hoplite. And as a result, you really couldn't get close to them. If you were just like the Persian army was, say, a million, some say a million strong, some say more, some say less, but it's a huge mass of people fighting individually. And they sort of bash against the warriors at Marathon. And because of that essentially quite homoerotic closeness that those Athenian warriors have, it gives them a strength to beat that, you know, to beat the Xerxes, the invader, and to sort of rescue all of Greece from these people, and to win a huge victory at Marathon, at which famously at the end they sent a man to run back to Sparta to tell them the news that the Athenians had won, and after 33 miles he dropped dead after delivering the news, which is why we call it a marathon race. There's therefore in this Battle of Marathon a lesson not only from military tactics perspective, but it gives us a kind of cultural message as well, which when we start looking at classical culture in what's known as the Golden Age, the Athenian Age, or specifically the kind of Periclean Athens Golden Age from 450 to 420 BC, this idea of the small group of like-minded fellow feeling men is essentially the idealized form of all of that society. So at this time, we can see in Athens, it's you know, very rocky, got lots of temples, it's all very kind of vertical and held together. The Mount Olympus in the back is where the gods were said to live, and so you're right near your gods there. But it was a town that was really social. It was a party town, and you know, there were theaters, there was drinking, everyone was communing in social gatherings. Social gatherings is the center of the whole of the life there. So. And all of these great people, who you would be forgiven for thinking must have been spaced out across the whole of the history of Greece, in fact overlap with each other between 450 and 420 BC. So we've got Socrates, Plato, we've got, you know, Aristotle in terms of the philosophers, we've got great writers like in the theatre, we've got Sophocles, Euripides, Aristophanes, we've got generals like Xenophon, we have Creon, we have Pericles himself, all of these great leaders and philosophers and generals, and we even have a young Alexander the Great there, and one of my favourites, Diogenes the Cynic, who was a strange man who lived in a barrel. If you've not read about him, I recommend reading about him. Famously, the young Alexander came up to him, and he was this philosopher who just lived in a barrel because he didn't think there was any point in owning anything. And he said, I am the great Alexander. I rule the entirety of the known world. I can provide you with anything that you would like. Diogenes, what would you like? And he said, I would like you to stand there. He says, oh, your wish is my command. But if I might ask a second question, Diogenes the Wise, why did you ask me to stand there? And he's like, well, the sun was in my eyes. I was just hoping that you'd give me a bit of shade. There's loads of good Diogenes stories. He's a cool guy. If we look at the art and the artifacts that come out of Periclean Athens and the kind of high point Athens, we find that, again, there's lots of drinking vessels, there's lots of wine, there's lots of stuff that is designed to be part of drinking parties. The Roman, the Greek word for a drinking party is a symposium, which nowadays has become kind of a, it means the same thing as a conference, like academics tend to hold symposia, but it essentially means drinking parties. And this is because this is how they did everything. If you wanted to do business, you had a drinking party. If you wanted to discuss politics or even make important political decisions, you had a drinking party. If you wanted to bring in some different kings of different states from the Greek cities, you would have a drinking party with them. Their worship involved getting drunk. Weddings, obviously, and wooing people was involved drinking. And all of their philosophers, as you'll note if you ever read Plato, tend to be walking around, going to or from parties, or sometimes, as in the case of the symposia, just drinking and chatting. And that was how the society ran. So we've got these sort of amphorae here, which figure heroic figures, giant monsters. They're used for carrying large amounts of wine around. They're designed to carry them in ships, and so that's why they're so large and have a lot of kind of maritime things. You've got this here, which is a drinking vessel. A lot of the drinking vessels are very flat because they would be shared around, depicting scenes from a symposia where everyone tends to be lying down. They tend to be sort of drinking, looking at each other. There's some young boys, there's some older bearded men. That for at this time was how you would separate adults from young men, would be whether they had a beard. After Alexander the Great takes over all of the known world at the time, men start shaving because it was seen as being a benefit in battle that people couldn't grab your beard. So that's how you can position them historically if you're ever interested in that. You also have scenes of kind of more erotic orgies, and then you've got scenes like this, which include things like the satyrs. The satyrs were part man, part goat. We'll see a few more of those later on. And they essentially were these totally libidinous, horny little creatures that existed to just get drunk and to mess with people. And maenads, this is a maenad who is a woman who has gone totally wild with drink and with desire and with music and lust and with poetry, and would kind of go into kind of semi-religious states of epiphany, where she would sort of see things, meet with the gods, and if you ran into a group of maenads, you were in trouble because they had a tendency to leap on men and rip them apart in a kind of lusty fury. If you look at the gods, you'll even see that the Greek gods tend to exist and be depicted in drinking parties. This doesn't explicitly look like one, in that they're not holding, you know, wine cups or anything like that. But the way that the pantheon is arranged, we have, you know, the standard tropes that you'd expect with a pantheon. It's a pyramid. At the top we have Zeus, who's the most powerful. That moves down to the less powerful ones. So we have like Orpheus, the god of music, and over the other end here we've got Mercury, who's the sort of messenger of the gods. And they kind of move up in status. But they tend to be sat around, they tend to be talking, they tend to be kind of in a state of that lounging state that you always see on the kylixes and on the amphorae, people drinking, people relaxing. And in the, you know, the writings, they tend to all be kind of milling around. It's the same thing, it's Athenian culture. It's a lot of drinking, it's a lot of chatting, and that's kind of how things get done. Interestingly, this image of the gods in a pantheon gets picked up and moved into the Roman world, which was a little bit more bureaucratic and didn't do quite so much drinking parties. But when they did, they really went for it. And then it also gets lifted by the neoclassical period, as we'll see in the Baroque era. And you get a lot of Catholic art in the kind of Renaissance that mimics it. And there's, you know, at St. Paul's, you can see all the saints essentially arranged like it's a Athenian drinking party, but just because they've lifted the form and put new figures into it. If you look at the architecture of Greek culture, it's all to do with bringing large numbers of people together. So the pinx is incredibly important from kind of a historical perspective, but is not, well, I don't know if you can call it architecture, it's just a big rock. But the pinx is essentially where you were free to say whatever you wanted. So it's like Speaker's Corner in London. It's the first place, I suppose, where a democracy recognised the importance of freedom of speech. Even if everyone in all of Athens thought one way about the gods or about society or about how things should be, if you went to the pinx, you could stand on it and you could shout to your heart's delight, you know, all of your crazy beliefs. And people would come and listen. Sometimes they would come and laugh at you in your face. But it was the cornerstone of that Athenian democracy. And this grew, and you had forums, and you had kind of market spaces, and then you had the huge amphitheatres. And the amphitheatres were used both for theatre and for political speeches and kind of political meetings, and for religious rites as well. And the reason that they're so big is because it was the responsibility of every Greek citizen. It began with the Athenians, but it spread to Corinth and places. If you were a member of that society, you had to go to the theatre at certain points. There were certain sacred days when you had to, which puts in perspective writers like Aristophanes really well. So essentially, you had everyone in the whole town would go there. And Aristophanes' plays are basically just taking the mick out of people there. There were recognized satirists whose job it was to take the piss out of people sat in the audience. So he'd be laughing at Creon, who was, you know, the great leader, but then he'd be acting out how foolish he is, or how Creon's wife is sleeping with his general, and Creon would have to sit there and take it while everyone laughed at him. There's a play called, is it called The Clouds or The Birds? And it's basically attacking Socrates. He's like, Socrates lives up in Cloud Cuckoo Land, and he'd have all of these Athenians dressed up as cuckoos running around, and everyone would be laughing at Socrates, and Socrates had to be there and take it. But it brings everyone together. It turns them all into one big party. The gymnasium is the ultimate example of this, because everyone went there. It was a place for working out, but also for gossiping, for sort of hanging out. And everyone was naked, and there was a lot of kind of physical contact and a lot of erotic kind of passes being made. It was very Greek. If we look at the Temple of Concordia, we can see a classic little sort of classic bit of temple architecture, what you expect to see when you think about classical architecture. Emerging out of the Greeks, thing it's lifted by the Romans and taken sort of wholeheartedly. If you remember last week, I talked about, I have my pet theory that if you look at what a culture does with its pillars, you can kind of find out all about that culture. Well, whereas last week the Egyptians put their pillars in rows so that they could walk through them as a processional, here these giant pillars are used to hold up a huge stone roof that seems impossibly heavy. It seems to kind of float there like a tombstone waiting to fall down. But they mark out a space, a rectangular space, and that's a meeting place where people can come and worship the gods, and they tended to worship communally as well. They didn't have an altar at the front. They would all gather around and perform the ritual sacrifices together, killing and burning animals together. Sometimes, if it was a Bacchanalia or a Dionysian rite, they would all kind of dance and get drunk again and have kind of mad orgy-type scenes in them. But the function of these giant pillars was essentially to form a communal space around them. If we look at the Parthenon, which was the biggest Athenian temple, it still is around. You can see again these pillars around a communal space. It's a gathering space. It's like almost cave-like, but without any walls at all. You can see all the way through. It's full transparency in the architecture. Around the top of the Parthenon were these sculptures, which are currently in the British Museum. They're one of the most contentious pieces in the British Museum, called the Elgin Marbles, sometimes called the Parthenon Marbles, largely because Lord Elgin basically nicked them because he thought that the Greeks weren't doing anything with them, so we might as well have them and take them over to London. But they're really important and fascinating high points of Greek sculpture. So we see this idealization of the body, and in this case, it's human bodies and centaur bodies. So this is depicting a scene, again, it's another mythological scene, between the Lapiths and the centaurs. And the Lapiths were like a tribe of Greeks, and the centaurs are centaurs, but they're depicted as a tribe. And they have a marriage because there's a female centaur and a male Lapith have fallen in love, and they're going to have a wedding ceremony, and they get married, and then during the wedding feast, they all get a little bit too drunk, and it all gets a bit leery, and things get out of control, and there's a massive fight between centaurs and men. People have suggested this could mean all sorts of things like that, the trope of kind of wildness versus order or things like that. I think it's just a good old-fashioned Greek story where everyone's having a fight. So you can see even the horse anatomy is highly kind of developed. You can see on this body here, the amount of detail that goes into the sculpture and the way that the use of that soft marble has allowed him not only to show the outlines of a body, but you have the impression there of a rib cage. That's like the diaphragm sucking in. You can see the ribs, you can see the kind of muscles and the way that the muscle masses move around. And we also have added to this appreciation for anatomy, an appreciation of how human bodies themselves can be used as part of a dynamic setup. So there's this idea called contrapposto, which, as you can imagine, is only named in Renaissance Italy, but it's here with these. And contrapposto means counterpose. And it's the idea that rather than stand there like a very kind of geometrical figure like the early Spartan ones, or a very geometrical Egyptian figure where everything is aligned and symmetrical, you embrace asymmetry. Every single one of the limbs needs to be doing a different, slightly different thing, because that's how humans actually act. It also creates a sense of the body in motion rather than still, which means you're doing something, you're alive, you're vital, you're filled with living energy. And in this case, it gives you an arc. So here, neither of them have heads, but what we think is happening is that this chap here, he's got this big long cape on, and he's got an arc to his body. That leg creates a powerful arc. It's like a bow that's being drawn, and he's grabbing this centaur that's sort of riding past by the neck and snapping his neck. And so his arm is in a big bow, and then the body of the centaur is bending in this dramatic way as well. And by introducing that bend, it creates a sense of movement and tension in that line. If you think of them as kind of bows coming together, you can see it here. There's a centaur who's kind of diving down a rather weak and pathetic looking Lapith. And he's there, he's got this weak kind of punch that's extended, but you can see there's absolutely no force in that. It's a kind of punching like this, a sort of limp-wristed, because he's collapsing. His face is showing that he's, you know, out for the count. And if we look at the arcs between the two of them, here's this giant centaur coming in. He's pulled like a bow, about to release a massive amount of force down. No one knows what he was holding, but it was perhaps a club, a spear, a sword. Doesn't matter. It's about to come down on the head of this guy who's bent like this. He's bent as a kind of, if you think, see them as two bows, this guy has all the tension, and this guy is just limp, waiting, falling back, attempting to kind of get out of the way, but failing. And so there's a huge amount of force and power going into the strike that's going to hit him. And this kind of image of human bodies in conflict, in motion, demonstrates the high point of what's possible with classical art. So we shall move on to the Romans. Here's some Romans doing what Romans do, oppressing and slaughtering some people. I think they're actually killing Greeks in this one. So the Romans are, until they take over the Greeks, which happens in 146 BC, they are already a very kind of pragmatic people. They invent things very quickly, and they're hugely warlike. But they kind of lack a culture. So if you think about societies into cultures, they lack that cultural element. They've got a lot of kind of stories about war. So their early myths include, you know, that they were founded by two, Romulus and Remus, two children who were raised by wolves. So they're kind of part beast, vicious fighting people. They have the myth of the rape of the Sabines, which was essentially that a bunch of Roman men went to the nearest town and killed all the men and stole all the women and dragged them back to Rome because they'd run out of Roman women. They're not very sophisticated myths. They're kind of violent and vicious. And so when they took over Greece, they found this pre-prepared, perfect kind of culture waiting for them. And they just lift it and they take it and they give it new names because they speak Latin rather than Greek. Although all their intellectuals spoke Greek and all of their thinkers tended to be Greeks. And they also changed some of the emphases a little bit. So although, for example, Aphrodite becomes Venus, Aphrodite tends to look on sort of young love and innocent love as being something nice, whereas Venus is just kind of erotic. She's just happy when sex is happening. So like prostitution, which was rife in the high courts of Rome, would be looked on happily by Venus, but Greek Aphrodite would not be much of a fan of that because there's not much love involved. It's more commerce. And you can see the same thing in like the gods of war and the depiction of Mercury and things like this. So there's some changes, but largely we see a Greek culture move into a Roman civilization. The difference being that the Romans are driven to conquer, whereas the Greeks are quite happy to sit in their boat and be the strongest Athenians in the boat, and everything that happens in Athens is all that's important to them, and they just see everyone else who's not Greek as a barbarian, which basically means someone who says ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, because they thought that all of the languages weren't even really languages, only Greek was a language. The Romans instead take this ideal of the kind of perfect man and turn it into the idea of a perfect warrior, and the kind of going out, being a member of the Roman Republic and a sort of fighting man, meant going out and conquering and taking over other people and sort of showing your dominance over others out there. That kind of Greek sense of the gods being terrifying things that kind of have no morality is then developed into an idea of Pax Romana, the peace of Rome brought by the sword. Livy, I think it is, one of the Roman philosophers, talks about, you know, the strong do as they please and the weak suffer what they must. It's a very militaristic society. We can see this in the way that they react to some of their great men. So they've got people like, here we have Augustus Caesar. There are hundreds and hundreds of these statues. Augustus Caesar was, Julius Caesar was his, Augustus was the adopted son of Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar, at the time when Rome was conquering most of you know, its nearby neighbors. They decided that the democracy, the republic that they had, there's too much backbiting, there's too much kind of cowardice, there's all of these rich people, they're trying to do politics. Instead, we should be a military state. And so Julius Caesar, after having gone and taken over all of France and some of England, he turns around and he has a civil war, kills all his enemies and becomes emperor. He then gets betrayed, stabbed, and in the resulting chaos, Augustus Caesar becomes the Caesar, the man who brings peace. And he's kind of the ultimate embodiment of an emperor. He sees himself, during his time, Rome expands to almost the whole of the known world. They defeat all their enemies and start just kind of doing colonial warfare, pushing the boundaries back as far as Scotland and in North Africa down to the deserts. They pretty much got as far as it was possible to go. Any further, there seemed no point in it. And as he was dying, he also kind of unified the ideas of architecture, of art and design. He tried to, whenever they would encounter sort of strange foreign gods, they would allow them to be worshipped, but they had to worship the gods of Rome as well. And they would kind of encourage them to go, oh, well, you've got your own god, like the British god Epona is the goddess of the hunt, so maybe you could just change your name to Diana, you know. And so he standardized, he bureaucratized, he made that standardized Roman system. And on his deathbed, the people of Rome and in the Senate decided that he was such a good leader, we shall make him a god. And so there was a ruling that Augustus Caesar is now one of the gods of Rome. You are legally obliged to have his statue among the statues that you have of your gods in your household, and you're legally obliged to worship him as a god. And as he dies, they didn't say he died, he just went straight up to heaven to join the gods in their kind of endless drinking parties as one of them. This is around 30 BC. Now, you can see that he's gained clothes, so he's not a kind of classic Greek hero figure, but he wears armor that shows important messages about Rome. He's got the toga, which is the symbol of kind of sophistication. So he's a philosopher from the toga, but he's also a warrior from his armor. He's got that short hair from Alexander the Great, which means that you're a conqueror. And he's got this little strange baby looking up to him. That's the people of Rome looking for their strong leader, their strong daddy who will look after them. And he's in perfect proportion. And these statues tend not to be too big either. They're about 6 foot, sometimes 7 foot. They're normally life size or slightly higher than life size. We can see in this the idea that men as gods is the culmination of the Greek ideal of man as the measure of things. But from this point on, it all starts to get a little bit, I don't know, starts to degenerate. The Romans took over everything that they could. And as we see, culture moving into civilization has built within it the seeds of its own downfall. So if you look at some of the Pantheon, which is probably the greatest work of Roman architects, it's an absolutely gigantic temple. Here, this huge dome is bigger than anything else that's ever been built. We would struggle to make something like that out of concrete today, which is what it's made out of. The idea of the Pantheon was that, like the Greek temples, it would bring all of the people of Rome together, but it also had this idea that it would bring all of the gods of the whole world together. So all of the gods and all the deities and all of the kind of new gods, so every emperor after Augustus decided, I'm going to be a god too. Even the terrible ones, who definitely weren't gods, like Caligula and Nero, they had to make themselves gods, and you had to have statues of them. And so the Pantheon was filled with gods. It was a huge collection of gods, and the message was very clear. Much like those Greeks on their ship, it's that the only place that matters is Rome. The Roman Empire centers on Rome. Here is the Pantheon. All the gods live in Rome, in the Pantheon, and here's the light of God shining down, blessing the people of Rome. And the destiny of Rome is the Roman people who live in Rome, which is one city in what was essentially all of Europe and North Africa and the Middle East. This gives a huge amount of meaning and power to the Roman people. It must have meant at the early stage of the Republic, you were incredibly proud to be Roman and were willing to go out. And in order to become Roman, if you weren't born Roman, you had to serve in the army. And even slaves could kind of work their way up through gaining their freedom, then joining the army, and becoming a Roman citizen was something to be. But what it also meant was later on, they were paying so much attention to the handful of, you know, political events happening in Rome, they paid no attention to vast hordes of barbarians moving in through, like Attila the Hun, like the, you know, the Tartars, moving in through Northern Europe, moving in through the Middle East, the whole of their empire slowly collapsing around them, and they didn't pay any attention to it because they were more interested in who was sleeping with who in Rome. But yeah, this sense of Roman order instilled itself on this kind of map of the whole world. So if we look at some Roman temples here, can we have any guess where this one is? General regions of the world. It's quite massive. You can see there's a lot of portals near it. So this one's in the Lebanon. So that's the Middle East, and that's a Roman temple in the Middle East. This one, where do you think this one might be? Looks like it might be Greece. It's in fact North Africa, that's Tunisia. Any guesses where this one is? Bath. That's Bath, yeah, so you might have actually been to this one. This one's in England. There's no, you can't get away from that English sense of style. So you've got, all the way across the Roman Empire, identical buildings, identical ways of life, identical ways of dressing. From Bath in England to, you know, North Africa to, I guess, Spain, Italy, across the Middle East, we have this same shared sense of the classical, of there being a certain type of proportion. Everything is in proportion with sort of man as its model. But this stratifies, it kind of ossifies, it does that thing which we see, whereas the Egyptians become kind of stuck in their ways, but because that's part of their very philosophy, the immortality and the kind of endless rebirth of things, that there is no start or end. That works for the Egyptians, and it lasts for 4,000 to 5,000 years. The Roman Empire is premised upon conquest and upon individual vitality, upon the individual going out and conquering stuff. So what happens when all of Europe is already owned by the Romans, and you go anywhere across the known world and it always looks the same and everyone dresses the same? Well, what happens is they become incredibly insular, and when they become insular, it becomes about backbiting, about politics of the what's happening within the kind of the palaces of Rome. They start going through emperors at a ludicrous rate. At a certain point, you have about 3 emperors a year, because an emperor will come in, he'll get stabbed in the back by someone who'll become the emperor, then there'll be his household guards will chuck him out of a window, and then you have a new emperor. And so the only people who become emperors are either, sometimes they're kind of someone's unlucky nephew who gets thrust into becoming the emperor in the hope that they'll be able to control them, and then they get murdered and the emperor gets murdered. Or sometimes it's just total psychopaths, because you know you're going to get killed if you become emperor. So the only people that do the job are people who are either too dumb to realize that, or so narcissistic that they think, it'll be fine, I'll be the new Augustus, because there isn't anything much to do. And so we see in Rome a slow sort of removal of these heroic figures, because there aren't many heroic figures, and we have an increasing number of statues of of women, of nude women in particular, of Venuses. So there's a sudden flood of Venuses that occur, essentially playing a similar role to the Ephebes, the sort of boy statues of Athens. Some people do make arguments that there's a kind of idealized sort of wanting to aspire to be these figures, but I think some of them are very clear, most of them are very clearly desiring, they're objects of desire. So we have the Venus genitrix here, which is an early one, the Venus who is fertile. We can see this is an example of the contrapposto in a female nude, where each one of the limbs is doing something slightly different. It adds a line of beauty to the figure by having it slightly off center. This is a slightly later one, the Crouching Venus, which all of these are types. So they're not specific statues, they're types that get done again and again and again and again. So if you go to Liverpool, you'll probably be able to find some of these in the museum there. The Crouching Venus is fascinating because although it fits the, you know, it's a nude, I would say that it fits more that category of the naked. The whole sort of appeal of the statue is that, unlike the nudes of Greece and sort of Venuses like this, this Venus appears to be aware that she's naked and she's kind of trying to hide herself. And there's a sort of late stage Roman eroticism to be found in the fact that this statue is aware that she's naked and she's trying to hide herself. The Venus of Arles is the statue of a mistress here, where she's holding a fruit being a kind of sexual symbol. We'll be familiar with the use of fruit as a sexual symbol from the story of Adam and Eve, but it was also used in classical times, and she's kind of offering out the fruit to be eaten by the viewers, which is again that desiring impulse to make a statue of someone who wishes to be possessed. Here is her giving the fruit to you. And this one at the end is called the Venus Callipyge, which translates directly into the Venus of the beautiful buttocks. So yeah, no question as to quite what's going on with that statue. Latin has the most sex words of any language, by the way. The late stage Roman poets like Petronius and what's his name? Calidus? No, never mind. I'll remember it at a certain point. Either way, late stage Roman poets just like invent a million words for different sexual acts. It makes any other language just seem tame by comparison. The language itself is so full of them. It gets to the point with the, you know, such highly developed kind of erotic architecture that you end up with certain like erotic jokes. So this is a kind of erotic joke. It's called the Sleeping Hermaphroditus. And that top one would have been installed in palaces, in your palace. And, you know, your guests would come in and go, ah, Maximus, that's quite a delectable statue you have there. But tell me, is it a man or a woman? And then you would go around and he would show you. And on the other side, he'd be like, ah, I see it's a little bit of both. How tempting. And so you get this kind of extremely high quality depiction of human anatomy used kind of to get a cheap giggle, to be a bit of titillation. And then when we dug up Pompeii and moved all the lava off, we found that there was in fact this kind of statue was everywhere. So here we have a satyr having a bit of fun with a goat. This was in the center of the town square. So that's like the equivalent of Pompeii's you know, St. Peter's Square or something in Manchester, outside the town hall. Yeah, another kind of dirty joke. And these were door knockers that were found on the doors of Pompeii. Clearly mass-produced, was clearly a very popular joke. You know, if you go round to Sestorius's house, you have to grab the knocker and give it a bash, and they'd come out laughing. Eventually the empire descends into pure pornography, and when it's not making pornography, it's making absolutely gigantic colossus statues. So here we've got the Spelunga statues, which to be fair are a lot earlier, but they were put in a cave, and it's a kind of statue of a giant being killed by Roman warriors. But things like the Colossus of Bolletta from 450 AD, you can see here he's absolutely gigantic. He's about 5 stories tall, made of brass. And then we've got the famous Colossus of Constantine, which fell down, so we have its head and arms and feet and things. Here's, I don't know, she looks about 5'8 or something. She's about the size of his head. So yeah, a head the size of a person, and the body was in scale with that. Now, you get this kind of, the fact that these statues get bigger and bigger and bigger is intended to show the empire getting more and more powerful. But you have this impact where, in fact, it tends to show its opposite. As Shakespeare said, methinks the lady does protest too much. It's the idea of, if you're going to be, I guess, more theoretical about it, you would call it the idea of dialectics. Every time you want to show something, the more you want to make an argument for one case, one thing being the case, the more you sort of reveal the opposite to be the truth, the more you move in one direction, the more you reveal the other direction. And so with these gigantic statues of emperors, they always tend to be emperors that were really unimpressive that make the giant statues. You might think of them as nowadays in North Korea, where you have absolutely ginormous mountain-sized statues to Kim Jong-il, and it's like the size of the statue seems to indicate how less important people are. If we think back to Augustus's statue, which was just normal human size, and he was considered to be the greatest emperor. For each of these emperors, they build bigger and bigger statues, and the ultimate effect is to make the giantness of them seem hollow. It feels like they're vacant, they're hollow. The larger they get, the less impressive they are in terms of the meaning for the people that they're being statues for. I quite like thinking about the poem by Percy Bysshe Shelley, Ozymandias. I think it really captures this kind of contradictory nature of the late stage Rome's obsession with gigantic things. So this is a foot from Constantine's statue, which is, as you can see, a massive foot. Shelley saw this in Rome, and I think it's in Istanbul, which was called Constantinople after Constantine at the time. He saw it and he kind of had this image He then transplanted it into a desert, and he had this image of Ozymandias, and this giant sort of coming across this giant foot in the middle of a desert, and on it is a plaque that says, "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look upon my works, ye mighty, and despair." And this sort of captures the irony of it really well, because when Ozymandias first put these words onto his gigantic statue, he was saying, "Look upon my works, all of you. All you other people might think you're good, but look how big my statue is, and you have to despair because you will never have a statue that's as big as mine, ha ha." But now, the same plaque has had a totally different meaning, which is like, "Look upon my statue, all of you powerful people, and despair, because I was Ozymandias, I was the King of Kings, and all that's left of me is a big foot in the desert. So, you know, what chance do you have?" Finally, the kind of culmination point of this increasing hollowness and kind of superficiality of the Romans was that eventually they were going through so many emperors so quickly, and all these emperors technically had to be called gods, and you technically had to have a statue of them in your home, certainly if you were like a high up person, and so you must have been commissioning statues over and over and over again. They developed these essentially kind of adaptable statues where you would make the statue of an emperor's body, and you could pull out its arms and its head. And so every time a new emperor came, you could just sculpt a head and some hands and stick them in, because the hands would be holding things relevant to that particular emperor. Sometimes you might leave the hands on. But either way, you know, oh, another emperor's died, has he? Take off the head, here's the new one, commission us a new head, stick the head in. It's kind of like, you know, doing it on the cheap. Why bother to make a whole statue every time when you can just change the parts out? This goes to show, I guess, how the Roman culture ultimately kind of burns itself out. This idea of man as the measure of things, it gets fulfilled, and then it tries to kind of extend its lifestyle, but the civilization has fallen to bits. So in AD 410, Rome was sacked by the Gothic king Alaric, bringing to an end the Roman Empire, at least in the West. In the East, it becomes something else, where it kind of ossifies and becomes a lot more like the Egyptians, where people just keep dressing and living like Romans up until the medieval times, when people around them are kind of going, "Why are you still dressed like Romans?" But that's over in the Middle East. In Europe, this idea that, you know, the idea that was so powerful for the Greek cities, which was that us and all of us mates, we're the most important people in the world, and we'll all do plays, and they'll be the best plays in the world, and everything that we think will be the best in the world, you know, the Romans still thought that about Rome, even when, you know, news came that Attila the Hun was sweeping across all of Germany, there was riots in Britain, there were sort of things rising up across North Africa, there were, you know, terrible violence was going on, and the people in Rome were like, "Well, why do we care? We're in Rome. It's got nothing to do with Rome. Have you been heard that this emperor has done this, or, you know, the emperor's been overthrown again, and there's been, you know, tax evasion has been found in the accounting office?" And they were so obsessed with Rome that they couldn't pay any attention to the threats coming in. And so, for example, when Alaric and his hordes finally arrived at the gate of Rome, no one could be bothered to raise an army to fight them, because the people of Rome were so kind of self-obsessed that none of the generals thought it was worth risking their necks to raise an army to fight off the hordes. They essentially thought, well, if they take over Rome, then, you know, that'll be an end to it. We can finally, you know, put up with it. And so they knock on the gates of Rome, and they haven't got any fighting force. They just have to let them into Rome and sort of go, okay, well, take everything, I suppose. And that was the end of Rome, where no one even fought. It just kind of ended. And so Rome became deserted, and the Roman cities became deserted. Rome itself became kind of uninhabited, and then people kind of drifted into it slowly to steal, you know, anything left that hadn't been nicked by the barbarians. Over time, during the Dark Ages, there grew up this idea that these huge buildings were kind of natural rock formations, that these are essentially like strange cliffs that have appeared, because they couldn't conceive of anyone being able to build something like this. And so they just assumed it was natural, it was always there. Places like London and Paris became abandoned because they thought they were haunted cities. Again, they thought that these, you know, they couldn't conceive of people being able to do it, so they thought the spirits did. And when they saw the statues of humans that looked like humans, as opposed to their rough kind of wooden carving, they thought that these must be kind of terrifying gods and demons that will come to life if you ever go into the city. And so the Roman cities like London and Paris remained empty for ages. And then places like Thessaloniki in Greece, you know, in Macedon, where Alexander the Great came from, there's a really well-preserved Roman kind of ruins there, and that's because it was originally a temple. After the Roman Empire collapsed, for a little bit it was like shops, but then after a while they decided they didn't want it for that, and it became the local cesspit, the local toilet. And so it was protected ultimately because people just shattered it for century after century, and then eventually someone came along and took all of the feces out, and it had preserved the Roman temple. But you know, that's what happened to the Roman, to the end of the Roman Empire. This whole worldwide thing that seemed immortal just collapsed overnight. So yeah, the only real bit of the Roman Empire that survives, other than the handful of stones which we see around today, was was part of what undermined it was the fact that they gave up that original polytheistic view of the world and replaced it with a radically new monotheistic view of the world in the form of Christianity. Interestingly, that it was Constantine who turned the Romans Christian, even though arguably he had no idea really what Christianity was. He thought it would just give him more power. But yeah, the remnants of the Roman Empire last in the form of the church, because the church is essentially becomes a civil service, they're the last people who speak Latin. And we'll see next week that church architecture, the church becomes essentially the last lingering little bits of the Roman Empire that hold Europe together during the Dark Ages and give it that chance to come back again in the Renaissance and in, you know, the Middle Ages, and the Gothic emerges out of it and things like that. But that's for next week. For now, we'll concentrate on looking at some more classical sculptures and things like that. Let me stop the recording while we're here.